Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Unconventional Soldier, a military podcast brought to you by two British Army veterans in association with ISAR.com.
Welcome to the Unconventional Soldier podcast. Our guest today is Liz McConaghy, who spent 17 years flying with the RAF Chinook fleet. Age 21, she was the youngest aircrew member to deploy to Iraq and was also the only female crewman on the Chinook wing for 4 years. She completed 2 deployments to Iraq, followed by 10 deployments to Helmand Province on Operation Herrick. During her deployment, she survived not only a near-fatal wire strike on board her CH-47, but numerous enemy contacts. Liz is now a published author, and her book, Chinook Crew Chick, which she started as a side project during COVID lockdown, is out now, if you can get a hold of a copy. So thanks for coming to the pod, Liz. And we always start off with our guest backstory. So why did you join the RAF, and why did you want to be aircrew on Chinooks?
Well, thank you so much for having me. So I don't come from a forces family at all, although my brother is in the army. You know, we haven't got generations of forces people, certainly in our family. But my brother went to join the army whenever he was 17, and he went up to a place called Palace Barracks back home in Northern Ireland, which I'm sure you two are quite familiar with, where the careers office was. So he went up to do his BARB test, which is the entrance test for the army, and I went with him. And while he was in doing the exam, there was a magazine on the table, and it had a picture of a helicopter and some guy hanging out the side of the helicopter on what I thought was a rope. So I was fascinated by it. And I said to the chap in uniform, I was like, what's this job, this guy in the rope outside the helicopter? And he said, well, first of all, it's not a rope, it's a wire. And the job title is helicopter crewman. And that was me. I was just sold. I didn't really know much more about it at the point. I was just like, no, that is the coolest job on the planet, and I want to do that. So made the appropriate inquiries, had an interview at Palace Barracks, and then managed to get sent over to Cranwell for another interview, and then back over for like all the medicals and aptitude tests, etc. And then that's how I kind of got in. That's kind of what was the draw, really.
At the time when you joined, were all sort of trades open to females, or were there still certain restrictions?
Yeah, so there was no restrictions for the crewman trade. Although that said, it was only years later. I was at Henlow, the RAF Museum in Henlow, and there's a timeline around the hangar in there, and it's actually only 1996 that females were allowed to be crewmen, which wasn't really that long ago when you think about it. I mean, I joined in 2001, so it wasn't that long after. As I wasn't the first female by any stretch on Chinooks, but I was the longest serving in the and I was the only one for 4 or 5 years. So yeah,
it's amazing how much it's changed. And I'm giving away Kev and Mai's age here. When we joined up in the mid '80s, Kev was a bit earlier actually. But you couldn't be gay. You were kicked out for any hint of you were found out to be gay. Yeah. Stripped of your medals. Female service women were kicked out for being pregnant.
Yeah.
So Kev and I saw a hell of a change over that period that we were in to what it should be and what it is today.
And it's still changing today. Yeah, I mean, I'll say I was the only one for a couple of years at ODM. And then I think in our heyday, we had five female crewmen. I remember having to queue for the toilet one day at work. I was like, wow, this is novel. and now I've only heard recently that actually, so 7th Squadron is the Chinook Special Forces Squadron at ODM that do a lot of the work with the Shakies and the Blades from Hereford. And it was kind of an unwritten rule. It was never written in black and white that females couldn't go to 7th Squadron. But certainly in my time at ODM, it was never really the sort of the done thing, I guess. And there's two females going there at the minute. They're on track to go over there, and that'll be absolutely, you know, groundbreaking for a female pilot and a female crewman to go over and work there. So people, you know, they're still pushing through these barriers, and it is still moving forward, which is great to hear.
And 2 weeks ago, you had the first female soldier pass P Company, which is the second female to pass P Company, because a female officer in the Royal Artillery did it about 2 years ago. So all these boundaries are gradually being pushed and breaking down or breaking up through the glass ceiling.
And what I also have been really pleased about is, although those stories are making it into the media, those girls, and certainly myself throughout my career, never wanted to be singled out for being special. Because if somebody says to you that, oh my God, isn't it great she can do that job despite the fact she's a female, it's almost like saying we weren't capable of doing it in the first place. So I just always say it's the best person for the job, you know, and there are, you know, there are females out there who can cut the mustard. But there'd be nothing worse than them having someone make a big song and dance about it. And I'm sure that's probably what they don't want either.
Did you feel that sort of pressure on yourself at any time you felt there's a bit of song and dance and you're sort of always being wheeled out when dignitaries are visiting, or did that not
happen? It did happen a little bit. However, I was really lucky with my regional accent. I could always play the little joker card and say, I don't want to be any part of this because I'm from Northern Ireland. We had an all-female fly past when the Women's Memorial was unveiled in Whitehall. And we couldn't even scrub together a crew of four females on the wing at the time. So myself and another girl called Hannah, who was the pilot. And then we had a guy called Dave in the cockpit, who was Davina for the day. And Glenn, he was Glenda for the day. So we just made up the names for the purposes of the BBC commentary. But it was actually just two men and two women. So, yeah, it was, but he did get it quite a lot. It was always a bit of a focus, but managed to hide in the shadows quite a bit.
Well, I'm surprised at that as well. You knew what you wanted to do right at the beginning. You want to be in the Chinooks. And you had a career in that. Because most of us who join the army probably haven't got a clue when we first join what we're going to end up doing. Because we just join, go through the sausage factory and turn out the other end. And then options are thrown at you.
Yeah, well, through our training system, because if you joined, in old money when I joined, it was Loadmaster was the whole name of the branch, brackets crewman. And you could then find yourself on fixed-wing aircraft or rotary aircraft. So whenever, as you go through training, you do basic training, which is the classic, you know, running around at Cromwell with a pine pole on your shoulder. And you come out of that as a sergeant, which is already pretty mental when you think about it. You've been in the Air Force. I've been in the Air Force for 3 months. I was 19 years old. And I'm now in the sergeant's mess with wearing a sergeant's rank tie. I was like, I have no idea what is going on. And we used to get called plastic sergeants, really, you know, quite fairly, because we didn't have a clue, some of us. But you learn pretty quickly. But then whenever you go through, like, sort of the basic loadmaster training, which is still at Cromwell, like ground school, you get given a dream sheet. And on the dream sheet, you can put fixed or rotary. So a few of the guys wanted to go fixed wing, which always struck me as like, why? Why would you? You know, I was just always hooked on helicopters. And they were like, I mean, to be fair, who was the fool? Because I spent my entire career living in tents in deserts and on military plane. Most of them were checked in, like the classic RAF thing, checked into hotels all around the world for their 17-year careers. So maybe more for me. But yes, yeah, so you fill your dream sheet in, and I always wanted rotary. And then at the end of Shawbury, which is our basic helicopter training, you get given another dream sheet and you can write down which helicopter type you want to go on. But for me, the reason why it was Chinook was, if you're going to do a job, I mean, if you're going to be a bear, be a grizzly, right? So if you're going to do a job, you want to go on the biggest helicopter that can fit the most inside and the most underneath, and that's a Chinook. You know, we've got three hooks instead of one, and you can fit, you know, two Land Rovers inside there and 40 troops. I mean, at an absolute push, you can get 60 troops in there. So, you know, if you're going to be challenged at work, then why not pick the best one?
I've been in there with 60. It's not much fun.
I mean, in the heyday in Herrick, when it was pretty tasty operations, we used to have to take the Gurkhas in, and they would be stood up in the cabin with ropes across the top of the cabin for them to hold on to. And we would just jam them in. And it was like, just stop counting at 40. Don't count anymore. Yeah, it's quite.
You get more Gurkhas than the smaller blokes, aren't they?
You'd be amazed what you can fit in there, though. I used to look at stuff outside the ramp. you know, you get to some of the fobs in Herrick and the ramp would be down and you'd just be like shaking your head going, there's not a hope that all of that out there is going to fit in here. And it's amazing what you can get in when you try.
Fewer restrictions in the wartime environment as well, imagine, or do they still pay lip service to sort of peacetime flying?
No, it's really good, actually. It is, you know, operations and exercises, the huge umbrella and the huge caveat that we can use out there. So, which is good because it gives you the chance to actually get your job done and know the rules, because it's that class, you know, it's like passing your driving test. You actually don't sometimes learn to drive until you're on your own and you've got no one else to ask the question of. Mm-hmm. And when you're suddenly faced with like it, you need to know how the CAG of the aircraft works and how the restraint. So that actually, if you have a heavy landing, which is quite likely in Afghanistan, you need to make sure that actually you are doing your job properly. So you really earn your salt. But you need to know the rules and how to bend them, but bend them safely. So yeah, it is good.
So coming from Northern Ireland, what were the issues with you joining the forces? And you've mentioned, obviously, you've used it to get away from some of the dignitaries.
Yeah, so I didn't have that many issues joining because, and I think there's a real different perception in Northern Ireland between people who are in the army and the other forces. And it's been like that my entire career. I mean, I was still had to be very careful when I went home. We would always get a security brief and then we'd go back, you know, before we went home and leave, or as soon as you got back home, you'd have to report in somewhere and get a security brief. But I never felt particularly under threat. And years and years into my career, I was in Herrick and the RAF regiment got given freedom of the borough back home in my local town. And there was a big parade. And my mum and dad went along and met whoever the chief of the air staff was at the time. And he said, oh, and my mum said to him, oh, you must know our Elizabeth. She's in the RAF. Classic mother life. And he said, oh, no, where's your daughter today? And she said, oh, she's in Afghanistan. So whatever happened, the local councillor got hold of this story and decided that wouldn't it make great PR for him, mostly, that I was given freedom of the borough when I got back. So I came back from Afghanistan and mum's like, yes, we're going to Stormont, which is big government buildings back home, in my number ones, feeling very uncomfortable in my number ones, driving through, you know, back home, driving up towards Belfast. But it is actually really safe, you know, in that respect, I think. But my brother, again, who was in the army, would never have worn his uniform off camp or, you know, being very careful going in and out of Aldergrove. And you just think, essentially, when we're all away, we all wear the same uniform now. You know, I was an MTP most of my career as a crewman, not RAF Blues. But they're just that perception's just so different back home.
I've never heard that before. That's interesting.
Never.
Well, I think that's because our memories are from the 80s.
That's probably exactly it. You know, Kev, I think there's that hangover, really, of, you know, British soldiers walking the streets. Very likely.
Yeah, so our memories are totally different and we don't go across there enough to see the changes and the normalisation.
Yeah, and it has changed. I mean, don't get me wrong, there's still, there are still, you know, cells of people over there you wouldn't want to bump into around the back of the shopping centre. But Castle Court, I think it's called. But, this, you know, it has changed a lot. Belfast is a phenomenal place now. Yeah. And back even from when I left, and I left in 2001, but there are, you know, high-rise glass buildings, which you just didn't get back in the 90s. In fact, you know, from the 80s onwards, you just didn't get high-rise buildings with glass in them because it was just too much of a risk. Whereas it's very cosmopolitan now and very trendy.
It is. Well, 4 years ago, I went across there and I went out drinking the Europa, which was the most bombed hotel in Europe at one stage. And now it's stunning. Yeah. Absolutely stunning inside. Now, I just wanted to go there because I never had a chance to go there before. And I just wanted to go in there. It's great. Absolutely.
Did you go
fantastic.
To the Crown Bar across the road?
That's that Victorian one, isn't it? With all the little, it's a beautiful old fashioned bar. That.
No, I never got there.
Definitely worth a visit next time. Definitely.
Yeah, that's really nice. So, Les, what was basic and aircrew training like for you?
So, I went through in 2001, and as I say, I was only 19. I joined on my 19th birthday. And I'm going to do that classic thing where I go, it's not like this now. It's far easier now. But back in our day, we would do a lot of sort of, because we were coming out as sergeants, we had to do a lot of leadership tasks. So our basic training was very much focused on, I mean, the basic core skills of like how to make your bed space and marching and drill and all those kind of things. And I was quite lucky that one of my best mates who I joined up with was ex-RAF regiment. So, I mean, I didn't know anything about drill, could not march for toffee, and he kind of, you know, spent most of the weekends helping me out with that. And the same, you know, you learn all the rank structure and all that kind of stuff. And again, at the beginning, the RAF just have stripes. It's just one more stripe and one more stripe and one more stripe for bigger officers. So I just saluted everything, I think, including the corporal and the main gate at the start. I just had no idea what was going on. So you kind of learn all that. And then a lot of the leadership training that you do, because you are coming out as a sergeant, is done on exercises. So you would go up to Otterburn and do lots of running around there, you know, with a, you'd have a lead, it was your turn to have a lead, so you'd be in charge of the rest of your troop, and it would be like, there's a Hercules coming in 45 minutes at this grid, and you've got to get everyone there, and build your pine pole into like a tripod, and that kind of thing. So it was all that sort of stuff. And then at the very end, you all get stood in a big circle. This is after the 3 months of basic training. It's called Black Tuesday. And essentially, if they call your name out, you turn around and you salute, and you go back to your bed space because you've been recoursed. And if they don't call your name out, then you've got through. And I genuinely could not believe it when they didn't call my name out and I got through. And then it's a stay at Cranwell for a bit more basic training on loadmaster stuff, and then off to Shawbrain and eventually wherever your front line is.
So I take it you're doing a lot of technical stuff, like, you know, how to strap down vehicles that go in the Chinook, load distribution, quite a bit of technical stuff
that
as well.
That comes when you get to the OCF. The OCF is an operational conversion flight, or operational conversion unit, it's called now. And essentially that's when you get to your aircraft type. So you get converted onto that aircraft. So we only learn all those skills when you get to the Chinook front line, because there's no point in them teaching everybody how to put a vehicle inside a helicopter if half the course are going to go to Puma, for example. So most of the stuff up until that point is things like laws of the air, rules of the air, stuff about principles of flight, radio communications, CFG and weight and balance calculations, which are the same on a fixed wing aircraft that you go on holiday on, and they're exactly the same in a helicopter. So it's kind of, and map reading and navigation and all that kind of stuff. So it's more those kind of skills, and a skill that we as air crew refer to quite a lot, which is crew resource management, which is essentially learning that if there's four of you in an aircraft, four of you as a crew, you can't, as the pilot, do everything. So it's how he offloads the tasks to make the mission work to the rest of the crew, which sounds really obvious whenever you're talking about it now, but actually they're so used to, because the pilots come through basic training on helicopters and fly as a single pilot. So they're used to having to do the radios, do the maps, clear the tail themselves on the little squirrel helicopter. So suddenly they just go into another landing site and they don't offload that stuff to the crewmen. So it's kind of learning to get them to offload a little bit, and for us to offer the help and kind of like all pitch in together for one big mission goal.
Crew resource management as well is also about how your rest periods and stuff, like, because you can only fly so many hours in a 24-hour period and so many hours in a week. Is that
yeah,
correct?
Yeah. And you always have to have 10 hours off, 8 hours for sleep within that period, for busy safety, because out in Afghanistan that would burn up pretty quickly, and it was like eat, sleep, fly, repeat. Mm-hmm. So you'd literally go to bed, head would touch the pillow, back up again, back to the aircraft. And yeah, we had I think the cap in Afghanistan was 10 hours flying in a day, but you could get that extended by the theater commander to 12 hours, and then extended again. And I think the longest day I did was 16 hours, and at 16 hours just being shaken to death on the back of that machine. But that was quite,
I mean, physically and mentally, that must be quite exhausting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's 45 degrees out there, like kind of average in the summer. And you're obviously wearing body armor and your flying helmet. And then if you're doing a long day, you're doing day into night. So you put your MBGs on and have your counterweight balance. So it's a pretty brutal job on the body, I've got to say.
So you were the only woman on your flight for 4 years. What was that like? Did you feel like you were breaking the glass ceiling?
No, not at all, because as I say, there was females before me. I wasn't the first females on Chinook. Whenever I arrived, though, the female that was there was just being, she was just leaving to go to a different trade. So yeah, it was just me initially. And I never got singled out, never got made to feel anything special, or, you know, picked on, or, you know, I just felt like one of the lads, and the lads would look after me like big brothers, really, or it's like having 60 uncles at one point. Even on a night out, we used to call it the Ring of Steel, because if I was out trying to pull, I'd just have like 10 lads around me and couldn't even catch a glance of anyone else. I'm like, fuck off, lads. But the only thing was, I couldn't get away with anything, because being Northern Irish and being blonde and being the only female crewman, like if I parked badly on camp somewhere, somebody like, oh, seen that little blonde crewman, can't park for toffee. Or if I was drunk in the bar the night before or whatever, you know, I was just so easily identifiable that I couldn't get away with much. So I had to be squeaky clean for a couple of years. But Yeah, never got singled out. It was really good. And I think the first,
I think
I'd recommend anyone in the force, you know, any female listening to this, Forces is an awesome career. And it doesn't matter if you're female or male. And even if you're going into quite a unique trade within that, everyone's just got the same goal. And as long as you're good at your job and you're credible and you're a team player, then you're part of the team, no matter what you look like.
I totally agree. I think the army, sorry, the forces in general, all three services, don't get the credit for what they've done over the last 25 years. But now you have women serving in the infantry.
Absolutely.
So in a space of 16 years, it's completely about to.
Well, I think we spoke to Adam about this as well, because on Herrick, there was a stage where you had women medics then going into the patrols on the ground. And that was unusual. But after a while, that just became the norm. The medic would turn up, regardless whether they were male or female, and would just be absorbed into the patrol and off they would go.
Absolutely. And I noticed that throughout my career. So I did 10 Herricks all up. And I remember from my first couple of Herricks, seeing a female out there. I mean, seeing a female at Camp Bastion was pretty much unheard of. So after me, it was a bit like, you know, like 100 meerkats when you'd walk into the dining hall. Like every bloke in the entire room would turn their head and you were really aware of it. But, you know, the first couple of years, it was, you know, there was very few females. And then towards the end of the campaign, certainly from the middle of the campaign onwards, you know, 07, 08 onwards, every time we lifted, you know, there'd be female medics, like you say, dog handlers.
And
they became less and, you know, it was less and less strange to see these females. And I always had so much respect for them because, yes, although, you know, I did quite a blokey job, I guess, and don't get me wrong, humping and dumping most of, you know, two powers kit on the back of the aircraft and whatnot. It was quite a physical job, but those girls had to go out the back of the ramp with the Bergen on the same size as everybody else's. You know, they didn't get a Bergen full of feathers. They were carrying exactly the same kit as all the rest of the lads. And they were expected to keep up and just get on with it. And I had so much respect for those girls going out to do that.
So how soon did you deploy to Iraq on your first op tour then, Liz?
So I got to the squadron in February 2003 and went straight out to Iraq that summer. So I was out in Iraq by the August, and I went out to Iraq when I was still limited combat ready. So basically combat ready is essentially where you are allowed to get your L plates off completely and you don't have to fly with training staff anymore. But when you hit the squadron, you get given your limited combat status and you still have to fly with the training staff. You kind of learn all your skills, like frontline skills. So although in the OCF, you get taught how to operate the Chinook and fit stuff in and all that kind of side of things, the operational side of it, sort of the combat ready side of it, is done on the squadrons. And that is how, again, you kind of learn to cut corners, but do it safely, do it quicker, do it, you know, now that you're under fire, that kind of thing. But whenever I went to Iraq, I was still limited combat ready. And actually, I had my medals out today. I was polishing them off for remembrance this weekend. And my Iraq medal has AC McConaughey on it, which is Air Cadet or Air Crew Cadet. Because I was still an Air Crew Cadet technically on paper, because you don't get your substantive rank. This is all a paperwork kind of exercise, but you don't hold the substantive rank of sergeant until you're combat ready. So I was myself and only one other guy ever had that medal, which is quite weird. But so it was like I'd only been in the squadron a couple of months and I'm straight out to Iraq, and it was just such a baptism of fire. It was like, right, here you go, you know, go and learn at the deep end.
If that's your first tour, how did you find it?
So the thing with Iraq was whenever I got there, the war fighting side had been done. So we were going out there to routine tasking, which is essentially just moving a lot of the troops and kit and stuff around the theatre. And Eagle VCPs was the thing we did quite a lot with the RAF Reg, and that's landing on roads, chucking the RAF Regiment guys or whatever infantry unit it was out the back of the aircraft. They'd go and search vehicles and jump back on board again a few minutes later. So it was fairly benign, really. The heat was the first thing that hit me, because obviously being a little Northern Irish girl, it was just mental the first couple of days. And one of our engineers nearly went down with heat stroke. So I remember thinking, you know, this isn't Kansas anymore. This could kill you. But I always referred throughout my entire career to normality bars. And in Iraq, you know, we would go into places like Basra Palace or the Shal Arab Hotel, which were along the river. And those sites had been mortared like the week before. And I remember thinking, oh, God, that's dangerous. This place is mortared like last week. And then the next time I'd go in, you know, it'd be mortared the day before. And then towards the end of the tour, maybe it'd be mortared that morning and you'd still go in. But it was always safe. It was always cleared and you guys would get the green light to go in. And even at the start of Herrick, that was very similar. Herrick was quite benign whenever we got there in 05, 06. And we only were operating out of a few bases in Herrick to begin with, around Southern Helmand. and there wasn't that many British troops on the ground, so it was still really benign. But whenever it did start to go kinetic and did start to ramp up, your normality bar goes up with that. So suddenly, you know, you're going into sites that have been RPG'd 20 minutes before, then you're going into sites that are, you know, taking incoming fire, and then you get cleared in. And then the next thing, you're going in under a hail of bullets, or you're on the landing site getting RPG'd, and it becomes really normal. And I think that's the takeaway. I look back now and think how normal that close danger was for all of us, I think. And, you know, you just didn't flinch because you were just zoned out to it by the end.
Like, that comes with experience, doesn't it? You know, which you can only get by living that life.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I was lucky in that respect that I feel like I got very much, you know, taken into it at baby steps. Whereas some of the crewmen that joined the fleet in sort of 06, 07 had, you know, done the same journey as me through basic training and then Shawbury. And then before they knew it, 6 months later, they're out in Herrick and they're not only getting shot at on every landing site, you know, not just bullets, but RPGs, mortars. They are also picking up, you know, not just, you know, injured bodies, but dead bodies and bits of bodies on the MERT stuff. So, and that was pretty brutal for the middle chunk of Herrick. The MERT was like scenes of MASH some days, and those guys just were straight into the deep end. And some of these lads were only like 22, 23. And I always, you know, look at that particular era of people and know that it's left lasting effects on them.
Prior to going out to Iraq, you're sort of doing all you're still sort of in a training pipeline for your basic and trade training, if I can call it that. But did you do any sort of role-specific training for theatre? Like when you're in the army, for example, you'll do pre-deployment training,
do PDT,
and that can be like 3-4 months.
Exactly the same. We do all the PDT that essentially the army would do, maybe a bit less running around in the field shooting each other. But we have to do all the weapon skill, like weapon handling skills, because we have to train as if we could go down at any moment. So do not get me wrong, the RAF are never infantry soldiers. And if you've ever seen the shambolic PDT that we do, it's more like, yeah, it's more Private Benjamin than Saving Private Ryan. But we do that. We also have to do the dunker training, which is part of our sort of training as we go through in case you have to ditch in water, which is down at Yeovil, which is where you get strapped to the helicopter and it goes under the water upside down and in the dark and you have to escape. I'm a bit of a water baby and I do love it, but some people just hate it and you just see people trembling, and because it sort of pauses before it drops. So you kind of go up to like your chest level and you're sat there and then it just goes. So if you haven't caught your breath at just the right time, then you've absolutely stuffed it. But you have to wait until everyone else is out of the helicopter before you, because we as the crewmen kind of wait to go out last. So you've got about 6 or 7 guys who have to punch the windows through and then swim out. And if they get confused or they get stuck, then you're just sat there holding your breath, just hoping for the best. So we do that. And then we also do, I think, with the Level C course, which is, we have a nickname, it's called the A course, but it's essentially the escape and evasion course that people maybe listening to this would have seen on SAS, Who Dares Wins. It's the old, you know, you get your hood on, you basically go on the run for a week, then you get caught by the enemy, the hunter force, and then you get interrogated. And it's probably the hardest course I've ever done. But, you know, we have to do it so that if we're prepped, that I'd much rather have done the training, and if it ever had ever happened in Afghanistan, know what I was doing and be prepared for it, then, you know, go into a theatre like Afghanistan without having that kind of, you know, mental mindset that I know what to do if the worst happens. But it's a pretty hard course. And then in terms of flying training, we would go away to somewhere that was hot and dusty. So in the old days, it was Morocco. We spent a couple of years going to Jordan. And then luckily we went to California the last couple of years, which I must admit I could never complain about, because in my support helicopter force, completely different to the fixed wing guys, like I mentioned earlier, there was no hotels in my career, very little. But, but California was not bad. You know, we got to go to California and stay on an airbase out there and do some dust training, because we had to learn to operate the aircraft in dust and in mountains as well.
It's interesting you mentioned about escape and evasion training, because I think that became mandatory for all RAF aircrew after the Gulf War in 1991, I think, because they found out that a lot of the aircrew weren't properly prepared for when they were captured. Did that come out in your sort of briefing?
Yeah.
Did it, Liz?
It was quite famous, a lot of the video footage actually of them and how they, whenever they were doing their interviews under duress, some of the behaviours that they were using, like show their British their Union Jack on their sleeve to the camera and trying to show their injuries onto the camera as well, just kind of like get whoever was watching the videos at home to know that, you know, they were doing this under duress, and all those kind of little subtle things that if you hadn't gone through the training you would never know to do. So yeah, everyone had to do it, and it was a prerequisite for going to theatre. You couldn't go to theatre if you hadn't done that.
And what gunnery training did you do? Because on the Chinook in Afghanistan, right, you had what? You had the GPMG or M60 or and a chain gun. I can't remember the armament.
We had an M60 on the ramp, which is essentially the weapon they used in the Vietnam War. It was a bungee on the side of Hueys in the Vietnam War. So it's a bloody old gun, but it's pretty trusty. I used to call it old trusty. And then at the front, we had on the left and right hand side of the aircraft, we had a minigun M134, which is made by Dillon, and it fires 3,000 rounds a minute, which is a lot of rounds a minute. So even if you didn't get your tracer on the first squeeze, it wasn't hard to walk your tracer on with that thing. But I was a gunny instructor. So, you know, we would work the guys up before we went out to theatre. And the thing about, you know, those weapons is that they're obviously designed to defend the aircraft. We're not an attack helicopter, and we don't have those guns entrusted to our command to go and just hose down Taliban. That is not what they were there for. We had Card Alpha was the rules of engagement in Afghan at the start and at the end. In the middle, it escalated to a thing called 49 Alpha, which was essentially where you've got a little bit more freedom of manoeuvre. And anyone north of Highway 1 wearing a black turban was considered Taliban, and you were within the rules of engagement to open up and shoot them. And some people did, don't get me wrong, some people did and did it completely legally. But I was always of the belief that if I pull that trigger, I've got to live with the consequences for the rest of my life. So I almost had like an inbuilt chip of like, if it's him or me, it's him. You know, when I get to the moment where I know if I don't pull this trigger now, someone's going to shoot at us and we're going to, you know, potentially lose an aircraft, then that's when and only then I would have pulled the trigger. But yeah, we train a lot in terms of overshoot kind of profiles and stuff like that on the ranges around the UK and out in California, because I don't think once in my life I've ever been shot at when it's been an appropriate time. It's always at the most inconvenient time. You're either about to land or you're about to take off, or you're on the landing site, which is extremely hard because you can't bring the guns to bear on the landing site, because obviously I've got limits, so you can't shoot the end of the rotor blades off, which means if you're on the ground, it's extremely hard to shoot back with a minigun. So it's almost better that you're airborne. But you're never flying straight and level when you get shot at, because as soon as you call contact, the pilot starts to maneuver. So you're now trying to manhandle this gun that weighs 57 kgs in the airflow onto a target. So that's what we train the younger guys to do.
It must be quite difficult to control with that weight. And is it stabilized in any way, or is it just on a...
No, it's just on an arm bolted to the door of the aircraft. So, I mean, it weighs, like it is heavy, and I have to use my entire body to kind of push it, because the airflow, if you're flying at 120 knots, the airflow pushes the barrels back into the 6 o'clock, well, the sort of 5 o'clock of the airframe. So you've kind of got to push yourself the opposite way against the handle grip to kind of get it, bring it to bear. So it's a skill.
After Iraq, you deployed to Afghanistan. We've touched a little bit on that. How did you find the difference in theatres when you went to Afghanistan?
So, yeah, like I said about Iraq, it was kind of very playgroundy. You know, there was a bar in Iraq and we could drink on a night time. We could have two tins of beer. We always had more. But when you got to Afghanistan, there was no drinking. It was big boy school, no drinking. And initially, we were based out of Kandahar, the whole Chinook force was, because Bastion didn't exist. And Bastion was essentially just a barbed wire fence in the middle of the desert, about an hour's flying west of Kandahar. So we were the whole Chinook force were pretty much instrumental in underslinging and putting internally all the kit that built Bastion. So nearly every day we would put, you know, we would load the aircraft up at Kandahar, and we would have, well, it was like a bad game of Jenga. You'd put the ramp down and it'd be like step ladder, cement mixer, cable drum full of cables, bricks, you name it. And it was all going towards Bastion. So we would understand all that stuff in. And then we had one crew at Bastion holding MERT, because we had a couple, you know, we had British boots on the ground, but they were again only in Goresh and Lashkar and a base up in the north of Helmand called Kajaki at the top of the river.
Sorry, Liz, can you just explain to listeners who might not know what MERT was?
Yeah, so MERT was the Medical Emergency Response Team. So essentially the flying ambulance, which any BBC News programme you maybe have seen over the time that we were in Herrick, it was mostly footage of the MERT. And we would hold standby a response time of 15 minutes during the day and 30 minutes at night time to go and get any British soldier and actually any Afghan local. And at one point, we even got tasked during my time on MERT to go and pick up a Taliban who had been involved in it, troops in contact with our own British troops, which is pretty, like, morally quite hard. But, you know, we got tasked to go and do it. When that's the response times, it never took us that long to get airborne. I think my fastest time was, you know, under 5 minutes. You would go from the dead of night to being on the aircraft, arming up, going over the fence, to finding yourself flying into a hot landing site 10 minutes later. which in itself, you know, is one of those things we, I don't think you realize the cumulative effect of that until years later, of that completely, you know, asleep in your bed to suddenly getting absolutely shot at 10 minutes later. But that cumulative effect, it does ingrain itself on you. But yeah, so Afghan started slowly. It was a slow burner. And within about 3 years, British forces started to push up the Helmand Valley. So we put FOBs up the Helmand Valley, which is forward operating base. So you had Camp Baston as the main base. All these little FOBs started to pop up the Helmand Valley to kind of gain ground back. And it stands to reason that the more British troops you have on the ground, then the more trouble there's going to be, the more bullets are going to fly, and the more IEDs you get found. And from about 07, 08 onwards, MERT started to get really busy. And I mean, my busiest day on MERT, we had 14 shouts back to back in a day. So we'd be bringing casualties in, landing at Camp Bastion at Nightingale, which is the HLS there, offloading the casualties and going back out for more. It was pretty busy. And, you know, that's, I'm not unique in that respect. You know, a lot of people had days like that. And then the other thing we would do, the other framework tasking, was just moving those troops around the FOBs, relieving them with new troops, taking in their ammunition, their water, all the resupplies. And that's what I loved about the Chinook Force, is that every day we made a difference to those guys. You know, whether or not it was taking in their ammunition and the water, or if it was taking the blueies from home, when we put the ramp down, we made a difference to those guys on the ground that day. And, you know, that goes all the way much from delivering a letter from mum to recovering them when they've been blown up. You know, we made a difference. So it was quite a privilege to be involved in that campaign.
Can you just explain a bit more in detail, Liz, about the MERT teams? Because explain the sort of setup within a MERT, because it's quite interesting, I think. And it's more or less a flying, you said ambulance, but in some respects, it's like it's a flying surgical ward. So you could just explain the makeup of a MERT, just so listeners get a better idea.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's always one crew on standby, and a standby crew and a standby aircraft. So you've essentially got now always a fallback option for the MERT. It was taken with the highest priority. It was the highest priority task that we held in theatre. And the MERT gang, was made up of the four crew of the Chinook. We would stay in one tent. Then in the next tent along had the medics in it, which, and the medics consisted of a combat medic, an anaesthetist, a doctor, and then another medic. So about four of those guys. And then the next tent along had the force protection, and we'd have usually six force protection, which would be whatever regiment were in theatre at the time and allocated it. So what would happen is we'd sit around watching Game of Thrones or whatever was the box set at the time in our little tent. You know, you couldn't go far from the tent because you were on that response time. So, you know, no gym here. You know, we're not talking, you don't go to the gym, you don't go to the internet, you are just bungeed to that tent. And in the corner of the tent, we had a field phone, like a green, really old school field phone. So if one of the troops in Helmand up the valley or wherever got injured, and that could be anything from, you know, IED strike to troops in contact or whatever, or sometimes it was really benign injuries or, you know, a driving incident, but it was still, you know, considered an injury, they would send through a thing called a nine liner that would go back to Bastion HQ. And a nine liner is a really clear reporting format with nine lines, obviously, and it covers the grid, the call sign, mechanism of injury, what the injury is. And the injuries were categorized in a T system. So T1 was the worst injuries you could get. So this person needs recovered now. They've got less than an hour to live. T3 was walking wounded. And then T2 was somewhere in between. So pretty poorly, but you know, you've still got to get there. And then T4 was someone who died. So we would get that the nine liner through. It would go to Bastion HQ. It would then get phoned through to the back phone. So we would be sat there watching a box set. The phone would go and we would pick it up, get the nine liner details and sprint out to the aircraft. And the phone would go in each of the tents. So whenever you heard the phone go in our tent, we'd get called first. And then you'd hear it get ripples along the other tents. The engineers were at the end and they would get the phone call as well. They'd ring a bell. So almost like back to like Battle of Britain type stuff, they'd ring a bell. Everyone would just sprint out to the aircraft and we would get the thing spun up as quick as we could. So it was basically like complete organized chaos. You would have the engineers taking off any covers that were on there, but most of the time it had already been prepped. The medics would be putting on their headsets and getting needles prepped and all the cannulas ready and oxygen or whatever they needed, because they would have got the same information as us. So every injury was different. So they'd be prepping what they could. We'd be spinning the aircraft up and then the force protection guys would be getting their body armor, etc. on. And then we'd lift and go. And sometimes on a nine liner, you would just get a grid and a call sign. You didn't have any more information than that. Sometimes what you would get would be a mix of T3s, T2s, T1s. sometimes it would be a T2, but on the way it would become a T1 because the injuries had got worse. And very often it was just the confusion of the battlefield. And certainly whenever, you know, these things don't happen by accident, it's usually because somebody's being contacted by the enemy. So en route, things could change quite quickly. So we would get all that information on the radio as the crewman. We'd be on the attack radio. So essentially at one point we would switch from Bastion HQ over to the actual troops on the ground on the attack net. And they'd give us the most up-to-date information. I mean, sometimes you could actually hear them. They'd be running to the extraction site, and they were running whilst talking on the radio, whilst carrying stretchers. So you could hear the chaos going on. We'd then land, put the ramp down, combat medic would run out with the force protection guys. They'd give all-round protection around the aircraft, and we would then get the casualties loaded on board. So if we knew it was a mass casualty situation, we'd pull up all the seats in the back of the aircraft and just get as many stretchers on as we could. As soon as that was done, get everyone back on board, which in itself could be quite confusing because you've got to count everyone back on. And because you've got all different amounts of casualties, sometimes you're just trying to, and you've got the guys who've been carrying the stretchers on still on the back with the weapons and whatnot that they're handing over. So it's complete chaos. You need to make sure you've got exactly the right amount of people back on the aircraft and then lift and head back to Bastion. And it was, we always used to ask the medics if they wanted high and smooth, because if it's a head injury, generally they wanted to go quite smoothly back to Bastion, but that's a little bit slower because you have to climb and descend. Or did they just want to go straight line, fast as you can, straight there, which was a bit lumpier tactically. Obviously you're more likely to have to maneuver, but for some of the injuries they just needed to get back as soon as you could. And then we'd land at Nightingale Hospital site at Bastion and be met by the firefighters there, who were they used to help carry the casualties off the back of the aircraft and load them into the stretchers. And then off they would go into the end of the hospital. And then it was reset, go again, or go back to watching Game of Thrones. And we never used to chase it up. We used to be very good at packaging it up as an event, you know, considering the people that we flew back just as very precious cargo. But we knew it would be quite detrimental to then go and follow some of those stories up, because not everyone made it, obviously. Some did, some didn't. And certainly if anyone died subsequently because of their injuries, op-minimised would be called around Camp Bastion, which is where all the internet gets switched off so that those jungle drums can't get a message back to a family without the proper channels. So all the internet gets switched off, the phone lines get switched off when op-minimised was called. And it used to break your heart because you knew that you'd brought that casualty in, and maybe half an hour later, op-minimised would be called, and you just knew that they hadn't made it.
You often heard all the tannoy there as well, announcements asking for certain blood types, which always used to be a bit of a wake-up call.
Yeah, we used to have op vampiris was what we called on the radio if blood was required back at Bastion at Nightingale. So, you know, if the guys were losing blood quite badly in the aircraft, we'd make that call, and that would get passed back to the hospital so that they could have blood on standby. And actually, this is a really nice thing that came out of Afghanistan. I mean, the medics out there, at one point, it was the only place in the world where you could survive a non-survivable injury, which is just an amazing statistic and such a testament to our British medics and combat medics that we flew.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
But whenever the Alton Towers incident happened a few years ago here back in the UK, one of the medics on scene there had done MERT out in Afghanistan with the British Army, and he called Op Vampire across the radio net that day. And the hospital, I think it was at Stoke, knew what that meant and they prepped the blood ready for incoming casualties from Alton or Alton Towers. So I think there's so many great things that that time in Afghanistan has brought back to the way the medical system here work. And certainly I think they're at the forefront now of dealing with amputees and those kind of, you know, head injuries and stuff that, you know, it never would have happened if it hadn't been for that theatre.
Yeah, you see,
What was interesting about Bastion Hospital, not only did you have reservists who were NHS, but we also deployed NHS staff through the MOD civilian routes. So we employed them directly in. They came in as MOD civilians and then did tours in Bastion, which people didn't realise. They were civilians with 3 days training for an operational theatre who were working in Camp Bastion in the trauma wards.
And they were amazing. They were absolutely amazing individuals. And we were, because we did so many tours out there, we would bump into the same ones quite frequently, you know, same old faces, be like, oh, back again for more. And we developed a really close relationship with the MERT, so much so that the MERT club like was spun up last year, and it's essentially, you know, for anyone who served out there on that particular task. And they marched at the Cenotaph last year for the first time, which I'd been invited along to go to. I've always wanted a march at the Cenotaph. It's been an absolute bucket list. And I was so lucky to be invited along. And there's a lot of security clearances you've got to do just to get there. And then 4 days beforehand, had a huge PTSD meltdown and had to pull out and couldn't go. And I was gutted. And when I did pull out, one of the girls who was running the whole thing said there were 7 people had done the same that week because they just couldn't face it. So, it's definitely left a lasting, you know, mark on a lot of people. But I am walking this Sunday, so it'll be the first time I'm going, and I'll be amongst friends and old colleagues, so it'll be good.
The other side of the medicine as well, I mean, it takes wars to advance medicine by almost decades in some respects, because you look at ambulance crews now, they all carry combat application tourniquets, like, even though they're yellow, not black. They have the same pressure dressings that have got the anticoagulants, the coagulants in the dressings. So, yeah, war does advance, even though as terrible as it is, it does advance life-saving techniques.
Yeah, I met a pacifist recently, Sheila Hancock, actually. I was at Yeovil Book Festival talking about my book, and I remember the whole day feeling like an imposter. I was like, I'm not an author, I'm just a crewman. And I got talking to her in the green room, and she was a pacifist, and we were sort of having a heated debate, shall we say, about war, because she doesn't believe in it. And she said, you know, that we didn't achieve anything in Afghanistan. And that's a question I get asked very frequently, especially whenever it, you know, fell to the Taliban last year. And I think we did achieve something. You know, if we got one young Afghan girl the chance to grow up and go to university and have a voice and leave the country, then we achieved something. If we got, you know, some young Afghan boys to be able to play with their kites for a few years, then we did do something. And ultimately, the thing about war, and I wrote a piece about this recently, is that it teaches you how to love. You know, I've seen so many guys lose their colleagues at their feet on the back of my aircraft. And, you know, that's just pure love. Unless you're really passionate about something and you love something, you're not going to fight for it. And those brothers in arms that you see out in Herrick, you know, that were really fighting for each other. And it was always, you know, I know it's controversial because obviously our queen passed away recently, but most of the lads I know didn't go for queen and country. They went because for their brothers left and right of them, they went to fight for their colleagues. And that's certainly what my driver was, because if I hadn't gone to war, somebody else would have had to go in my place, and somebody else would have had to take the risk and potentially a bullet that had my name on it. So I always went for that reason, you know, and to support my colleagues in that respect. And I'm pretty sure that's a lot of the veterans went, because, you know, it's for the guys left and right of them. And yeah, war teaches us how to love. It's, you know, it's a fact.
I think you're right. I think people think old soldiers and get together and the old airmen get together to celebrate war. They don't. It's like we had a 30th year memorial service for friends that were killed in Northern Ireland, and I hadn't seen some of the guys there for 30 years, and they turned up not to celebrate war, but to just make sure that these guys were remembered. Yeah. And the parents turned up, and it meant so much to the families that their sons were still remembered and their colleagues were there. You know, so yeah, you're right. I totally agree with you.
It's the friendships you make in the forces and the friendships you make in a war zone. I mean, I'm closest out of all my forces friends. I'm definitely closest with the guys I served with in the really bad times in Afghan. And yeah, that those friendships will last a lifetime.
Les, you've already touched on my next question, really, but I just want to explore it in a bit more depth. So on the books I've read about Bomber Command in World War II, what those aircrew experience was, they were in a safe base, And then in a minute, they were flying into danger, and then they're returning back to a safe location, having their bacon and eggs. It was quite a surreal and dislocating experience. Do you recognise that description?
Yeah. Do you know, you're so not aware of it at the time. You're really not. But you go from being completely, you know, flatlining, watching some box set, to then suddenly being, like you say, in this hail of bullets. And for the Chinook crews, because we were deployed so regularly, we would do 3-month tours, which meant that it would come around every year. And you were kind of out there getting shot at for 3 months, picking up dead bodies and torsos and, you know, seeing people die at your feet. And the next thing, you were home for sort of essentially like 6 to 9 months, because you had, you know, an element of PDT and exercise and stuff in and around there. But essentially you'd be back in your own house for 6 to 9 months before you went out again. And yeah, it became, in the early days, there was no such thing as decompression. The British Army only brought decompression, which was stopping at Cyprus for 2 days. They only brought that in from about 2010 onwards, which in itself was quite controversial, because most of the lads at the end of 3 months, end of 6 month tours, just want to get in plane and go home. But having done both, having done the finishing a merch out, getting on a TriStar, which was the air transporter in the day, and coming straight back to the UK, I've seen how I reacted to that, which was pretty badly. I came back and had a complete meltdown one day in my brand new house I just bought when I was away, and was just, you know, yesterday I was at, you know, war, and today I'm in Tesco's and people are stopping in front of me with their trolleys and I want to punch them. Or in an escalator, someone stops at the top of an escalator and suddenly I want to rip their head off. I'm like, not normal behaviour.
Did you do anything about that at the time? Because you obviously recognised it was not normal.
No, in any way. I found that, you know, within a couple of days of being back, you get used to civvies getting in your way. Sorry for any civvies listening to this, but that's the military ethos. You know, you've been in this very controlled environment where there are no, one thing that, I mean, I want to have my own kids, but one thing that really used to strike me was, you know, when you're away in theatre, you don't have traffic. There's never any traffic when you're driving around Bastion. You don't have children. You know, you don't have a lot of just the other noises and things that go on in the world, like busy streets and people stopping at the top of escalators, people annoying you with trolleys and Tesco's. That doesn't happen. So all those normal things that happen on a day-to-day basis here in the UK are, you know, you take for granted when you're away at war, they're not happening. And war is quite a simple place. You know, you don't have to worry about, really, you really don't have to worry about a lot when you're there, apart from not getting shot at, which sounds like, you know, quite a sweeping statement, but it's quite simple. Like, life is quite simple. It's eat, sleep, fly, repeat, bit of downtime, go to the gym, read a book. And yeah, so, you know, you get into this little bubble and then suddenly your bubble bursts and you're back here in the UK and on all that other stuff to deal with. And I've seen lots of people have meltdowns because of that. And then when Cyprus did come in and we had 2 days to stop in Cyprus, where you're allowed a couple of beers and you had a chat from the padre and all that kind of stuff. As painful as it was at the time, nobody wanted to do it. It did, I think, help a few people, because you kind of get everything you needed to out of your system. And then by the time you get home, you know, you can kind of settle back into normal life. You know, I've got a couple of colleagues who found it really hard to settle back into being a dad when they got back, because their wives had become so used to looking after the baby on their own that suddenly they got back and they were doing it all wrong. Oh, you don't change the nappy like that. You don't do that. You know, oh, you're gonna wake them up if you do that. And suddenly they're in the way. And they, you know, this is a lot. I've had a lot of guys feed that back to me, you know, said,
Oh, don't do what I did. I came back home off tour and on my post-tour leave and decided to rearrange the kitchen because it wasn't logical enough.
Uh-oh.
And my wife, who had been on her own for months, put me in my place, let's just say that.
Yeah, and I mean...
But it's hard, as you said, it's hard for your friends and family when you come back as well, because you are different, you're changed.
Yeah, and they, quite rightly so, you know, say, I've managed to survive without you for 3 months doing it just my way, so stop interfering with my routine. And they get their own little routine as well, which is half of their coping mechanism for being left on their own for 3 months, I think. So, I mean, I was married to a forces guy as well, so we both were quite similar in that respect, which kind of worked, I guess. We were both quite aware of each other's routines, but I can imagine in a, you know, if you're married to civilians, it can be quite hard to settle back in again when you come back.
So Liz, why did you decide to leave the RAF? And what was the effect operations had on you as a person?
So I would never wanted to leave, is the honest answer. I was med-boarded out in 2019. And having had a life on Chinook helicopters, which is, like I mentioned a few times tonight, it's pretty brutal on the body. And I passed 3,000 hours flying, which is a pretty hefty amount of flying. Really. And my neck had started to play up. it's like everything, I think, in life. You know, when you're carrying an injury, but you've got a job to do, you just kind of muscle on through it, don't you? And you're like, it's all right, I'll not worry about it yet. And I did that the whole way through sort of the end of Herrick. And it was about 2016, 2017. I was walking in from a sortie here in the UK, a flying sortie, and my colleague said something behind me, and I turned my entire body to answer him. And he was like, Liz, just go to the bloody physio. So I went to the physio with this neck injury or this neck problem and got grounded. And they did a little rehab, all that kind of jazz. It got a little bit better. And if I'm being honest, I kind of probably lied a little bit and said, oh, it's fine now. So just so I could get back flying. I went back flying again, did a tour in the Falklands and left the Falklands pretty much unable to move my entire upper spine. So I went through Headley Court, which was where the Centre of Excellence, essentially for anyone in the British military at the time with injuries. And what was really weird was when I was at Headley Court doing my spine course, there was only a couple of courses on and I was staying in the mess and it was really empty. And I mentioned it one day to one of the lads in the course, and he'd been there during the heyday of the Herrick campaign, and there was a waiting list for rooms and for people at Headley Court. And for me, that would just really brought it home that all of those empty rooms were literally jam-packed with guys with injuries from Herrick. Anyway, Headley Court couldn't really fix the injury, and it turned out that I'd damaged two vertebrae in my spine irreparably just from being vibrated to death on the back of a tunic wearing a helmet and whatnot. So, and, you know, you don't just sit with your helmet on, you're hanging underneath the belly of a helicopter through a hatch and you're rotating your head at funny angles and then you're chucking your night vision goggles on at nighttime and doing the same again. Mm. So it took a bit of a battering, really. But yeah, so I was med-discharged, left in 2019. They offered me a desk job, which I did for 3 months and then realised that I didn't join the RAF to fly a desk. And every time I looked out the window and saw Chinook lifting off on its adventures to the day, I just missed it so much. So I thought, well, you know, I was only 36 at the time, 37 at the time. And I thought, I've got the chance now to have a whole different career. And I'd rather do that than be, you know, handcuffed to a desk for the rest of my life, emptying the bins. So I took the med discharge and I left.
And what did you do when you left then? What was you looking at doing in civvy street?
So I really struggled, I guess, like most veterans. You come out really hard to put what you do in the military onto paper on a CV, isn't it? I mean, how do you go where I can shoot a minigun? How does that translate into a CV?
It's never going to happen, is it?
Unfortunately.
And because all I'd ever known was flying and I couldn't fly anymore, you know, I couldn't even apply for roles on helicopters in civvy street. So I found it really hard. I found the hardest challenge was to write my CV. And quite honestly, you know, anything to do with computer skills or a Microsoft spreadsheet brings me out in a cold sweat. I'd rather get shot at any day of the week. So I found it really hard, and I initially went to work for a disabled flying charity. I actually got introduced to them by accident through another veteran.
Yeah.
And they fly disabled people and veterans. They get grants from people like Boeing and stuff like that, and they have these wonderful scholarships where people, you know, mostly coming through Headley Court and the Help for Heroes schemes, could come to Air Ability and learn how to fly, like get their PPLs. So that was amazing because I was doing the scholarships for them, and it was a real sense of purpose, especially considering some of the guys coming through there were guys that I picked up in Afghan. So it was a really nice end to that full circle. Did that for a bit. Like I say, most veterans probably found it quite difficult to settle somewhere. So I did that for a little while and then got offered a job back at Odeon, operating the simulator there, the Chinook simulator. And I took it, I snapped it up because I thought, well, this is going to be just like being a crewman back at work. God's honest truth, it really wasn't. I went back and I was now in civilian clothes. I was pressing buttons on a computer screen while my old colleagues came in, flew, and then went back to the squadrons. And it was like watching everything through a glass window, but wanting to be inside the glass. So I only did that for 6 months and then went back to Air Ability because I just loved it there so much. And yeah, they absolutely give me the sense of purpose back, but it's just, it's hard even to fit in, I think, with the banter when you're in civvy street. I'm quite lucky that Air Ability and the disabled community on the whole, I have to say, I went into this completely with a different attitude. I went in thinking, you can't say that, you can't say this, you know, blah, blah, blah. And their banter is brutal, worse than anything I ever got in the military. They are fantastic. And I felt really lucky to be scooped up by them.
Going back a little bit on the transferable skills, we were talking about this on one of the other podcasts about those transferable skills, identifying them, trying to put down on paper, because 50% of what you know, absolutely useless. Yeah. And no one's it. Well, I did find, obviously, when I left as well, no one's interested in your bore stories either.
I just remember thinking, just at least give me an interview, because there were so many things I applied for. Mm. And my CV was crap, if I'm being honest, you know, because I just didn't know how to write it. And, you know, there's all those people out there to help you, but everyone has got their own opinion on a CV. Honestly, it's like, if you ever get stranded somewhere, just put your hand up and go, I need help writing a CV, and 1,000 people will descend on you. But but it, yeah, loads of the time I just thought, just meet me, just at least give me a shot in an interview, because then I can kind of, you know, you like to think most of us veterans actually, when you start talking about what you're passionate about, then you really light up, don't you?
Yeah.
And see that it really doesn't matter what task someone who's been in the forces gets given, they'll find a way to make that task successful. Be by hook or by crook most of the time. So it's just putting it on paper is the hard bit.
And I know what you're talking about looking through a glass window, because Kev and I both work for different organisations that took us to work in Iraq and Afghanistan as civilians as well. And it's I bump into Kev every so often, and it was just surreal when you're watching people you know go away and doing what they're doing in the army, and you're sort of in the front row watching.
The sidelines.
And, you know, you do feel a bit of guilt at times thinking, well, they're out there doing that and I'm here doing this. But, yeah, it's a really strange mindset to adjust to.
Yeah, so I find it quite hard, especially if I'm on the helicopter with a team going out to do something else and I'm going to get dropped off somewhere else.
Yeah.
Are you allowed to tell Liz that story about when you get kicked off that Chinook?
I went out with the omelette, didn't I? I jumped on with an omelette team because I needed a lift somewhere. I used to hitch lifts around because I was a single person floating around theatre doing my role.
I knew your type.
So I used to hitch a lift. Well, I used to pay in crates of juice to the guys on the ground at Little Heathrow, so they made sure to put me on a flight somewhere, and I didn't care who was flying it, what country, as long as I got on it. I mean, we arrived in Sangin, they got off and went one way, they pointed that way for the fob, and I had to lie on the floor to try and find where the fob was because it's that dark. I'm trying to find a silhouette of the Sangin so I can go knock on the door and say I've arrived. Yeah, it was good. That was a good
we used to get loads of people like that, hitchhikers around the galaxy.
There's a guy I served with called Andy. I'm hoping to get him on the podcast at some point. I won't mention his second name, but he's in a few books. And he was in an ambush in Afghanistan and he hit by an RPG, but the Taliban guy fired it so close that it didn't arm. But it hit his arm and took his arm off the elbow apart from one bit of sinew that kept it flapping there. Anyway, running contact. And in this book, the Chinook crewman is writing about the ramp goes down in the back of the Chinook. They've got the mert. They run out of a stretcher, and Andy refused to get on the stretcher. And he's like covered from head to toe in blood, and he walks up the back of the ramp. And this crewman said, crew chief said, he had a fag in his mouth. And we all know, being military, you don't go on a military aircraft smoking. Yeah. But he said, I looked at him and thought, there's no way I'm telling him to put that fag out.
No. Yeah. We had a few casualties like that. You know, there's I remember one guy who'd been shot, well, not shot, but he had shrapnel through his eye, and he was blind, completely blind, and he refused to go on a stretcher and kind of made his way towards the ramp, trying to feel with his feet to get up on the ramp, up the two ramps. And that hit me quite hard because it just suddenly occurred to me how, you know, disabling losing your sight is more than anything. You know, it was still walking and wouldn't get on a stretcher, but, you know, I thought that'll impact him forever. That,
yeah, well, that's what I hate, that term life changing injury, and that euphemism that's always trotted out.
Yeah,
when did you decide to write your book, Liz, and how did you go about it? Because I wouldn't know where to start. So, what was the process? And why?
So there was I had a life-changing event between leaving the forces and writing the book, which was, life was really good when I left the forces, left in 2019, and 2019 was a great year. I was like, hey, off, you know, don't have to go to Afghanistan, can plan my life, and just partied hard and had a great time. And then Boris Johnson locked us all down, didn't he, in 2020. And all my coping mechanisms that I'd used my time in the forces, like for all the trauma I'd seen and stuff, was the obvious things like keeping busy. We're all masters of that, aren't we? Whenever you've got something in your mind, it's just like, don't think about it. Just keep busy. Don't get in your own thoughts. And I used to go to the gym a lot. Used to, like most people, go and thrash out at the gym and run. Used to do a lot of running. And funny, the more trauma I saw over the years, I got quite good at running because I'd just run like Forrest Gump and then run a bit more, keep going. And when Boris locked us down, and initially you couldn't even go for 20 minutes outside, you know, it was like that we were allowed to walk or something, weren't you, around the block. And I lived on my own at this point, having gone through a messy divorce. So all of the coping mechanisms I had of keeping busy, seeing friends, you know, going to the gym, couldn't do. And as 2020 unfolded, I became more and more unraveled. I got insomnia quite badly because I lost all of my routine. I had no purpose in life anymore. I had no reason to get up out of bed. And I just stopped loving all the things I used to enjoy doing, like cycling and running and whatnot. And I developed insomnia really badly. And I knew that I was coming really unstuck when some of the evenings, some of the nights I was awake, looking up the back catalogue of the soldiers I picked up on Mert who hadn't made it, and kind of finding out whether, you know, did they have kids, were they married, you know, that, all that kind of stuff, and turning what was essentially a piece of freight into a backstory and a person. I knew at the time it was really dangerous behaviour, but I didn't say anything. Didn't want to be a burden on anyone and didn't want to let on that I was really coming unravelled. And then in August 2020, woke up one day and was just wanted it all to end, just wanted the busyness in my brain. I, you know, it wasn't like the voices to stop. I didn't have voices in my brain. I just had such a busy head. It just wouldn't shut up. So I ended up taking a huge overdose that night, 95 pills, and don't really remember much after that. Woke up in Basingstoke Hospital in high intensity unit 2 days later, incubated with a tube down my throat, and had survived. I didn't know how I got there. I didn't know who'd called an ambulance, didn't know anything really. And it was only upon, and the irony was, when I came around, I felt like I was drowning. I had this tube down my throat, couldn't breathe, and panicked whenever my eyes opened. And I remember my instant feeling was, don't let me die, like looking at these doctors' faces and thinking, don't let me die, just don't let me die, which was so in contrast to how I was 48 hours beforehand, when all I wanted to do was die. And I think, you know, when you look at how your brain can play tricks on you when you're really suffering with PTSD and trauma, that, for me, the day that I took the overdose was the most normal thing to do. My reasoned thought had gone out the window. I was emotionally detached from my body. I refer to it as like a day where I was watching my life through a movie. I had absolutely no control over my actions. But anyway, so I came around, eventually got out of hospital 4 days later and was reunited with my phone, which was back in my apartment from the night that I got picked up. And it turned out that I'd called the Samaritans for 13 seconds and then I'd called 911. Must have been watching too much Netflix during lockdown. But I called 911 instead of 999 at 10 to 1 in the morning. And it turns out that an ambulance crew found me, and I spoke to them a few weeks later to thank them, and they said if I hadn't lived next to the hospital, I probably wouldn't have made it. So I was a very lucky girl. But coming out the back of that then was the real journey. You know, that's, I thought the real low point of life would be, you know, attempting to kill myself. And I came out of the hospital quite euphoric actually, and thinking, well, it's not going to get any worse than that, you know, it's the low point in life, isn't it? And I was completely wrong. That was just the lid coming off everything. And then I had this huge journey to put back into my head all the files that I'd thrown everywhere that day. So I went through a lot of PTSD counselling, and I feel very lucky to be a veteran in that respect, because I know that the civilian system is not as good. But I was straight into a veteran system on the Monday morning and had lots of counselling. The initial counsellor I had, I didn't really click with. And I have to say, my lessons for anyone watching this who's gone through the same thing is, you know, if you're ever in front of a counsellor and you just don't get people, you know, different shoes for different feet and all that jazz, she just wasn't the right fit for me through no fault of her own. So I then moved on to a different counsellor, and she was brilliant, just absolutely, you know, helped me decompress and pull everything out and then look at it, read all the facts. The important thing I think I found was all of those files I'd thrown out that day, I had to read them and acknowledge the trauma on them. Instead of just scooping them up and putting them back in there, I had to read them, acknowledge the trauma that was involved in that, and then file it away. And that took nearly 2 years. And in that time, I started writing a lot of poetry, which is like quite cathartic. And then one day just turned to kind of like, you know, day one, Liz's life, day one. And that turned into 3 weeks later, the book. So it took me 3 weeks in total to write, and had no intention of it being published. I sent it to, I was actually out walking with my best mate, who's a civvy, and said, jokingly, I think I've written a book. And she said, that's amazing, send me it. So I sent her an email, and she said you should send this to some publishers, Liz, it's really good. So I did, and lo and behold, a year later, I've got a book on the shelves. So, yeah, and it's helped immensely. You know, writing stuff down really has helped.
You're the second author that's, we had an American guy, Chris Whitmore, on, who's US Marine Corps, and he's quite a similar journey to you, Rez, that he started writing just to get his thoughts on paper, and he said that helped as well. So it's really interesting that you've both followed the same journey. When you sent it to the publishers, did they ask you to play around with it much, or did they try and interfere in any way?
I was so lucky they didn't. I was actually kept thinking, have they actually read any of this? Because I sent, whenever I'd written the first draft of the book, that kind of like just Liz's thoughts on paper, it was about 35,000 words, which isn't really that much in terms of a book really. So, but I thought, well, that's the bit I want to get out. So that's all the stuff I wanted to brain dump, and sent it off to Pen and Sword. And when they came back and said, yeah, we want to publish your story, I expected that. I expected a lot of the swear words to be taken out, all the military slang. I mean, there's loads of really non-PC stuff in there. And I thought it was just going to be whitewashed. And it wasn't. They said, like, it's your book. It's your story. You write it as you want to write it. But it has to be bigger. You know, it's only 35,000 words. This is like a short novel. So, and I was like, that's not a problem. Like, literally, this is the tip of the icebergs of what I need to say on my story. So I spent about another couple of weeks just taking each chapter and kind of adding in all the extra bits that I wanted to put in there. And then it goes to him from the editors quite a bit. And most of that is just things like, the stuff we do talk about is military, like MERT and NVGs, which is night vision goggles. You know, I put a lot of that in there, and they said, could you explain what those are for the civilian readers? So most of it was just that and a bit of, you know, grammar correcting, but they were so good. They just let me have completely free rein. And yeah, I honestly couldn't believe it whenever it hit the streets. And they made a pretty good cover as well. I'm pretty lucky that the picture on the front cover, which is me behind the minigun, was taken by a colleague of mine in one of the, when we were actually taxiing out of Bastion for a deliberate op one day. And he was in the hangar about 60 feet away. And I had no idea he was even taking that picture. I looked like I'm grinning like a Cheshire cat, but I had no idea that Ben was in the hangar. And which kind of sums up my career, really. I was smiling most of the time because I was always having a good laugh. And he took that snap, and I've had it for years and put it on the front cover of the book, and pretty happy with it, I've got to say.
So what's your advice then for budding authors?
Well, don't do what I do and go through a completely traumatic experience and then try and have to put your life together. It's probably wrong to start doing it. But I think, be honest, you know, and everyone loves a really honest story. And I think if you just, I mean, mine's very much in a chronological order, you know, from day one joining up on the whole way through. And I think if you're just, I mean, humans are fascinating. I think we're all fascinating. And I especially think people who've been in the military are fascinating. But what most people have said about my book is it's different to the normal military books, because it's not just about this, you know, one time getting shot at with bullets. It's about how I perceived my career and what I felt about my time at war. And I think that's where, if you're going to write a book, you know, anyone can nearly get hit by a car or a bullet or, you know, lose family. But it's how you feel about that. And that's the bit where everyone's different. You know, the event is the same for many people, but it's how you perceive the event that's different. And I think that's where, if you're going to, you know, put thoughts on paper, that's quite a unique way to have a unique selling point, really.
Before I move on to the last question, I think it's important. Where can people get your book?
So I was really surprised, but Pen and Sword, the first run that they printed, it sold out in 3 weeks. So there was a bit of a delay for a while of people are getting hold of it. But it's back out again at the minute, and it's on the Pen and Sword website. It's probably the best place to order it from, because it'll get straight to you, or Amazon have got it back in stock again. And in my local Waterstones is Basingstoke, and they've got signed copies, because I went in at the weekend and signed all the copies in there, which was, again, like that classic imposter syndrome, especially when I was at Yeovil Book Festival a few weeks ago. I was like, I'm not a writer, I'm a crewman. And, you know, I just don't think of myself in that respect. So, but yeah, that's where people, and I'm on Twitter now against my better judgment. I was like, I don't really do social media, but I'm finally doing Twitter and Instagram. So, but I love, you know, if anyone's listening to this and wants to follow me, I just love meeting people. I love chatting to people. So it's been really nice getting feedback about the book. And that's, I think, the biggest lesson I've taken away from it is that my story has, not only some colleagues that I know and people I know really well have messaged me saying, oh my God, Liz, I was on a bridge one day and I was going to do this. And there's so many people I know who have been through similar stories and not talked about it. But there's also so many people who have connected with me who I've never met before. And just my opening up about their mental health, or my mental health, sorry, and my journey has really prompted them either to look at what they're going through and think, you know, I'm probably in a similar boat. And talk about it, but also for anyone who has been touched by suicide, because, you know, I make quite a clear point of this in the book, is that nobody could have changed what I did that day. I often referred to it as like being on a water slide, and you're only going one way. You know, I couldn't get back up to the top that day. I had mentally checked out of my life already that morning, and even if Daniel Craig had come around for dinner that night, he couldn't have changed what I did that, you know, that evening. I was on a mission. Like a robot. And I think, you know, I'm lucky that I survived, able to tell my family that and tell them how much I love them, because that's all, whenever I was on life support in hospital, that's all they were questioning was, why did we not see it? What could we have done? You know, is it our fault? And all those questions that come out from anyone who's been affected by suicide, I was lucky that I came around and I was able to tell them that there is nothing they could have done at that point. But there is something that everyone can do, which is just keep an eye on your mates. And you know, we all as a veteran community know our mates the best. You know, someone who's always down the pub, but then suddenly stops going down the pub is as big an indicator as someone who is never down the pub and then is always in the pub or stops going to the gym. All those abnormal behaviours. And the reason I think why no one picked it up from me was because we were in lockdown and I lived on my own. So the girl that was always at the gym, who suddenly wasn't going to the gym, no one could pick up on that for me, and no one could tell that I wasn't going out running. And all those abnormal behaviours were done in secret. So now we're out of lockdown, just keep an eye on your mates. And, you know, I think if you ask them if they're okay, we're classic at going, yeah, mate, I'm fine, I'm living the dream. We always say that, don't we? But ask them twice. Sometimes yeah. If you ask someone twice, it's just enough to tap the eggshell and break it. So, you know, hopefully those are lessons that people can take away from reading the book.
Well, thanks for your really honest discussion there, Liz. It can't have been easy for you, and it's certainly not easy to listen to, but the advice you're given is pretty much similar to every other veteran we've had on here that's had PTSD and has had been close to the edge or gone over the edge like you yourself. So reach out and keep an eye on each other, basically. Yeah. Last question, Liz, which you'd be glad to know. You've been invited on quite a few media rounds and to literary festivals. What's that like and how are you being received?
Still feel like an imposter, if I'm being honest, and still can't quite believe it. Yeovil was good fun. I had a talk down at Yeovil, which is a lot of the ex-Navy, kind of matlows and stuff like there, and helicopter crewmen in the audience, which is quite nice. Yeah, you got a lot of there was a lot of lovies there that day who are proper authors, and it was just me talking about my war stories. I think I'll get used to it. It might take quite some time really to get into that whole, that feeling of being an author. And coming back to the whole label thing and sense of purpose, as you know, military people, we'd like to be able to describe our name and then what we do, don't we? Like, I was Liz the Chinook crewman for such a long time of my life, and it's taken me a very long time to become Liz the something else. And now, you know, I am able to say my name's Liz and I'm an author. You know, it's not the only thing I do anymore. I've still got a day job, but it's nice to be able to have that label now and be able to. Oh, and I hate using the term labels, but we all do like them and we all do need one, I think, sometimes. Yeah. So
part of your identity,
yeah,
isn't it?
So it's been quite cool. And I've done a couple of book signings, which again, I'm absolutely astounded that somebody wants to queue up just to see me and talk to me and me to sign their book. But I'm extremely flattered and been overwhelmed with the support, if I'm being honest. So yeah, hopefully it continues. And it's out in America it's out in December in America and Europe. So Dylan and Boeing have quite lovely of them to like sponsor it and kind of promote it out in America for me. So based on the fact that it's got a massive minigun on the front page and it's all about my love story about the Chinook. So you'd like to think they'd support it.
Are you going out there? Are you going to be able to go out there to promote it, do you reckon?
If somebody else pays for my ticket, then yes, I'll be there.
You could take the women out of the RAF.
So, is there another book?
Yeah.
Are you thinking about another book?
I have, actually. I've got a...
Don't have to share all the ideas so people understand it. But, yeah, you're thinking about another one.
Yeah, so the book at the minute, my book is 17 chapters, and I served in 18 squadron for the majority of my career and the majority of my time in Herrick. So the next book I'd love to do, their stories, basically 18 people from 18 squadron, and let everyone's got a book in them. I'm convinced of that. It's just having the time to write it. So I'd love to be able to give 18 people from 18 squadron their chance to write what they perceived about Herrick. And like we spoke about earlier, everyone's got a different perception of war, and they were all in the same theatre and we were all looking at the same thing, but all of their perceptions will have been different. Right from the squadron boss, whose probably main concern was taking 60 people out there and bringing 60 people home. You know, my main concern was very much rescuing the troops on the battlefield, and the engineers would have had a different focus again. But even people like the safety equipment guys who fixed our helmets, you know, the INT guys, all the other people who are involved in that huge cog that makes the wheel turn, they all deserve a voice as well. So I really want to be able to kind of capture their stories as well.
As usual, we'll finish off with Des Island Dates. So a big thank you to Liz for coming on this podcast. We need your choice of book, your film and luxury item. So what have you chosen?
So I had a long think about this, and I think I'm going to have to take a dictionary. I know it's a really boring answer, but at least if you're on a dictionary, you're going to learn something when you're out there, and you can probably reread it a million times and never get bored of it. And if I'm going to have a future career as an author, it's probably a good thing to have. So that's the book. And again, film-wise, I love Forrest Gump. Every time I watch that film, I learn something new about American history. And I cry again every time, despite I know what's coming. And yeah, I just think it's an epic film. And luxury item, well, I've got a dog. I got a little puppy back in April who has essentially turned my complete life around. I could never have a dog when I was in the forces, for obvious reasons, being away all the time. So I got a pug called Mr. Shelby in April. And
after Peaky Blinders.
After Peaky Blinders. And he has changed my world around. You know, he is just that unconditional love and just having a little stupid face staring at you when you come in the door every day, especially when you live on your own. It's just, I know so many veterans as well who getting a little four-legged friend has absolutely changed their world. And now I can't imagine my life without him. So, yeah, Mr. Shelby.
They can be traitors, though. I remember, again, coming back from a tour. Oh, dogs can be traitors, mate. I went away on a tour to Iraq, and I came back, and when I left, the dog wasn't allowed on the couch, right? When I came back, not only was he on the couch, he's on where I normally sat. So I said to him, get off the couch, and he just sort of growled at me. And my wife said, he's been here the last 6 months. He deserves that chair more than you do.
Harsh. Yeah, Mr. Shelby rolls the roost around here now, I have to admit. He's, and he is a traitor. As soon as anyone else has got food, he's off there and he loves that more than me.
My choice is straddling our last guest, Zach from 75th Ranger Regiment, and Liz, actually, because it's Black Hawk Down by Mark Bowden. So it's set during the Battle of Mogadishu. January 1981, militias overthrew the regime in Somalia. United Nations go in, and then President Clinton decides to send in a task force in order to try and capture Adid, who is the warlord. And I'm quite sure a lot of people have seen the film, Black Hawk Down. So basically, Task Force Ranger go in, comprised of Rangers, Delta Force, 24th Special Tactics Squadron Airmen, Navy SEAL Team 6, and the 160th SOAR Aviator Regiment, which is a special operations aviation regiment that support Delta Force and all the rest of it. This led to several Black Hawk helicopters being shot down in an extended bloody battle. And to me, it shows up the sort of, not the best and worst of helicopters, but, you know, they can be a battle-winning asset, but they can also be hugely vulnerable, as you've already described, Liz. Yeah. There's only thin bits of tin and some vital components keeping that airframe afloat. And once they go down, as you saw in Black Hawk Down, the aircrew are extremely vulnerable. And hence, going back to what you described, your training, doing the escape and evasion and having to be able to fight alongside ground troops as well. And that was pretty much brought to the fore in Black Hawk Down. So it's highly recommended. So Kev, what's yours?
Mine's a book called Chicken Hawk. Funny enough, it's helicopter.
Yes, my favourite book.
By Robert Mason.
Yeah. I was going to pick that.
I know you wanted to pick this, but I'll dive out there first. Anyway, Robert Mason, it talks about his experience. He gets called up and joins the forces for Vietnam War. He goes through helicopter training school, and it goes into great detail about helicopter training. At the end, I felt I could fly a helicopter, although I probably can't, just by driving a car. It talks about his deployment, the experiences during his 12-month deployment to Vietnam. And then his post experiences, when he gets back home and all that's going on there. He then starts writing a book. And then there's a backstory that I found out recently was when he was writing his book, he was also smuggling marijuana from Colombia and then got caught and got arrested. So a third of his book was written. He sent it off to the publishers while he was waiting for his trial. Then when he was on bail, he was writing his book and he had to try and get it all done before he got his 5-year prison sentence, because once he went to prison, he couldn't carry on writing. He got his book out. He went to prison for 5 years, got a little bit of time off for good behaviour, and it was a bestseller while he was in jail during that period. But it's a fantastic book. I mean, it's not the typical Vietnam War book either. It gives a total different stance on it, but it's well worth reading. I read it in the 80s and the 90s.
We call it the Helicopter Bible. So anyone who goes through Shawbury, everyone's read Chicken Hawk.
I think we all read
another book called Low Level Hell, which is another Vietnam Huey book, and it's very good as well. You'll probably like it if you like Chicken Hawk.
Ah, see.
Oh, okay. Well, look at that. Okay. Cool. So, Liz, thanks for coming on the podcast. It was great to have the first RAF and our first female guest.
Female. Our first Irish.
And I won't say... Well. But that is not the term you used when talked to you about coming on the pod.
The first bog trotter.
Kev's of Irish background as well, Liz.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much. And I'll look forward to reading your book, Liz, because I've got it on order. It just it was delayed getting to me. So I'll put your social media links and all the rest of it on the pod notes, Liz, so people can get your Instagram and all the other bits and pieces. And thanks again to all our listeners for the continued support and suggestions. Please keep them coming in. And our email and social media links are at the bottom of the show notes as normal. You can find us all usual suspects, including Instagram, Facebook, YouTube and Twitter. And still stamps for Kev.
Yes,
you can download us from iTunes and like the podcast. It'd be great if you could leave us a review there or anywhere you get your podcast from. And thanks again to Nick Beale for his continuing support to the series and offering technical help for his company ISAR. And we'll see you next time on The Unconventional Soldier.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.